tonight. We're going to talk about the Christian worldview. As you read chapter 16 of my book, which is the last chapter, I decide to take the nine tests and the tests how to test a worldview and apply them to Christianity. And of the nine tests, I have to say, I think that I'm most impressed by the material I'm going to cover tonight. I think one very powerful element for the truth of our faith and the truth of our worldview is that the historic Christian theistic worldview does an incredible job explaining the nature of reality. And what I think is especially true about that is the scope of explanation. The other worldviews can explain certain things. But naturalism, postmodernism, pantheistic monism, they have very limited ability. And so tonight is a discussion of what I think the Christian worldview can explain. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's go right to it. Let me remind you, of course, that there are just a limited number of worldviews. We have, of course, the symbol of the cross there, the historic Christian theistic worldview. To some degree, both Jews and Christians share a common worldview. And so many times, the explanatory power that would be true of Christian theism is going to have to be shared with Judaism. If we believe, for example, that the book of Genesis does an excellent job of explaining or corresponds well with modern cosmology, well, remember, it's first their book, and we are embracing that revelation as being true. So there's, of course, the Christian worldview. A bit of a controversy, I think, in my book is that I talk about Islam being its own individual worldview. I know that many people think that Islam should be understood as one more component of the theistic worldview. Rather, I take them at their word. They see themselves as a distinct religion. They don't think they're the youngest religion. They think they're the oldest religion. And I'll explain that later if you'd like me to. They see themselves as their own civilization, and they see themselves as their own worldview. And with 1.3 or 1.4 billion, If you add the number of Jews and Christians together, adding Christians in terms of Christendom, you have more than half of the world's population in these two particular religions. The Tao figure there, the symbol, of course, represents narrowly the religion of Taoism, which is a very small religion, largely in Asia. I'm using it to represent kind of all of the Eastern religions, particularly the granddaddy of Eastern religions I would call Hinduism. And then, of course, you see the fish that has grown legs that has the name Darwin. And that is still a very, very powerful worldview. The numbers, of course, are much smaller than the religious worldviews. But the kinds of people that embrace naturalism tend to be in the great areas of academia. And so naturalism still wields quite a bit of influence in terms of the world. Well, rather than a disconnected or disparate group of related beliefs, a carefully examined and reflective worldview consists of a network of interconnected ideas that form a unified whole. So part of what a worldview is a connected group of ideas. If they're disparate, if they're disconnected, that means they're incoherent. So part of a worldview thought is to see them as being connected together. And of course, you know, we think about a network. Here's that cluster of beliefs that we have that form our worldview, our view of God, our view of the cosmos, our epistemology, our view of knowledge, our view of values, humanity, and history. The Christian worldview is intended to be a network of connected beliefs that mesh together. And one reason why I chose the Apostles' Creed to illustrate the Christian worldview is because it's probably the simplest presentation of historic Christianity in the history of our church. It's only 114 words, but the worldview implications are there if you simply bother to kind of draw them out, so to speak. Well, tonight I'm going to talk about two other critical tests. Last time we talked about the coherence test. Tonight we'll talk about the explanatory power and scope test, then we'll talk about what I call the cumulative test. And let's tackle the first one. What's the explanatory power and scope test? Well, it asks the question, how well does a worldview explain the facts of reality? How well does a worldview explain the facts of reality? We call that its power. And how wide is the range of its explanation? That's its scope. This is a pretty important measurement of a worldview. William Wainwright gives us, lends some importance here to this test. He says, quote, metaphysical theories, and that's what a worldview is, after all, a metaphysical theory. Metaphysical theories are better when they explain a wide range of phenomena. A system that illuminates humanity's scientific, moral, aesthetic, and religious experience, for example, is superior to one that only illuminates science. Well, I want you to think in your mind here, this is really a very sharp critique of naturalism. Naturalism is a worldview that says that the material physical universe is all there is. Well, most of what naturalism is able to explain are the natural physical laws of science. But naturalism has a whale of a hard time explaining things like morality or aesthetic. I mean, how would I survive better because I have the ability to have aesthetic impulses? You know, why would my ability to think about beauty, how would that lend survivability to me as a human being? Because if naturalism is true, then evolution is true. And what's driving the evolution is the idea of survivability. As my boss, Hugh Ross, likes to say, human beings are too well endowed for evolution to be true. We think too deeply. We have too many abilities that, you know, to survive, things like growing food, making weapons, those are things that'll help me survive. But being able to distinguish between the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, I don't see that as being a great deal of help in surviving. Even though there are people who would say, you know, the smarter you are, the more logical you are, the more you're going to survive. I'm not sure that's true. My father has often told me when we would talk about what it was like to fight in battle that philosophers get shot because they're asking why instead of keep your head down and shoot whatever moves. Well, whereas Christian theism, I think, does a good job of explaining why the universe is there, but it also explains things about me, my moral impulses, my aesthetic impulses, and the fact that humans are so religious. Well, one of Christian theism's greatest worldview strengths is the scope of its explanatory power, though admittedly, as I mentioned earlier, other theistic systems, such as Judaism, share some of that ability. When I say that the Christian worldview, or when I quote Alvin Plantinga in saying that the Christian worldview birthed science, I actually think you have to also grant a great deal of credit to this religion called Judaism. And in fact, if you look at Judaism, I'm not sure that there is any other philosophical system or religious system that has produced more scholars, more intellectuals, and the individuals have had incredible impact on society than Judaism. Maybe Christianity has more simply because we're just so overwhelmingly larger than Judaism. But obviously, the Jewish Christian scriptures agree, and we believe that those scriptures are true, but that God has revealed himself in the person of Christ, which is the final step of that revelation. The historic Christian worldview accounts for the vast array of realities in nature and in human experience, including the universe. Why is the universe there? Where did it come from? Why did it have a beginning? Why is it so orderly and regular? Why is there so much fine-tuning in it? Well, the Christian worldview says it's there because there is a God who stands behind it. It had a beginning, the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo. Its order, regularity, and fine-tuning is because God has made it that way. And so the Christian worldview has a explanation of why the universe is there, why this type of universe that we have is there, the beginning of time. How about abstract entities, the existence and validity of mathematics, the laws of logic and scientific models, which include their correspondence to the time, space, matter, energy universe as conceived in the mind of human beings? This is, again, getting at that issue, why does math work? Why does logic work? These are not things you can see. They're not physical in nature. And even the great Albert Einstein, who didn't believe in a personal God, he was Jewish, but he didn't believe in Yahweh. He seemed to believe in kind of a mystical God. But even Albert Einstein said, there is one thing I know to be true. The universe corresponds to mathematics. There is this mathematical element to the nature of the universe. Well, let's assume naturalism and the universe is kind of a brute accident. Why should mathematics work? This came home to me when I was a senior in college at Concordia University. I wasn't doing terribly well in my physics class, and the reason was because I didn't have a good preparation in mathematics to take my physics course. But the thing that struck me, of course, was, wow, why do these ideas, these conceptual ideas, these equations, why do they actually match the way the universe is? That makes great sense in the Christian worldview. It seems to me it is the strangest coincidence if there is no God. But a mind behind the universe makes sense of things like mathematics and logic. The beginning to matter, energy, space, and time. Why? How so? How do we explain these realities? It seems to me the Christian worldview has an explanation. And there's a story that I use in my book that I borrowed from another Christian scholar. I kind of like these TV programs called CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. And of course, what's interesting is you have these crime scene investigators at the beginning of the program, and they walk into a crime scene. You know, there's blood on the carpet, bullet holes in the ceiling, you know, the phone is pushed over, you know, and they start collecting all this data and analyzing it. And then what do? They look at all the data, and then they come up with the most plausible explanation as to how all this data came to be. And then they go to the district attorney and say, here's the data, here's what we think it proves. And then the district attorney takes it and says, okay, I think I can prove this beyond reasonable doubt. Well, this is not all that different from the way Christians reason, at least thoughtful, reflective Christians. We're reasoning an inference to the best explanation. We look at the universe, we look at mathematics, logic, and we say, what's the best explanation for all of this? And then we posit a story. We posit an explanation, and we say the best explanation is that there is a rational mind behind the universe that brought the universe into existence, and that's why the universe corresponds in its intelligibility to the human mind. Why does the cosmos correspond to a mathematical framework? Why? Paul Davies, a physicist that I like very much, who read Augustine and said, wow, here's a guy in the 5th century who is asking profound questions about the beginning of time. It's very interesting. Some of these physicists are very taken that theologians were talking about all these ideas centuries ago. So Paul Davies comes along and says, you know, actually Augustine's discussion of time is probably as good as we have today, which I think is pretty impressive. Well, when we ask these types of questions, Paul Davies has said, isn't it an amazing thing that human beings, life has evolved, humans have evolved, and we've come up with these very complex brains and this brain-mind relationship and our central nervous system, but now we're actually able to ask, why did the universe evolve the way it did? I think what Paul Davies is getting at is we seem to have evolved to a place where we ask questions that the universe itself can't ask. Why indeed? Doesn't that make more sense in a Christian worldview? That we would be creatures that would be able to ask the why questions? Sometimes my students ask me, why ask why? And my response is, why not? How about ethics? I think the naturalist worldview has a real difficult time explaining ethics. It's not that atheists can't try to live ethically. Some of them, I think, are doing the best they can to the degree that any human being can do the best they can, of course, because the Bible tells us that all of us are sinners by nature. But the question here is not whether people can have some sense of morality apart from God. Some atheists have said to me, you Christians, you need God to be good, but our morality is superior to yours because we can be good without God. They'll say, the only reason you're good is because you believe in God. But we can be good without God. Well, that's an interesting response, I admit. But I would actually argue, where do you ground your ethics? What's the foundation upon which they rest? Why shouldn't we just do whatever we want? I realize you can't just do what you want because people will take action against you. But see, that's not the real question. The real question is how do we ground these? On what basis do we ground them? Human beings, why are human beings here? Why do they exist at all? Why do they have consciousness? Why do they have rationality? Why is it that human beings are free agents? Because naturalists would say your brain chemistry, your evolutionary brain chemistry produces your thoughts. But my response would be, well, then you're not an atheist. You haven't chosen to be an atheist. You just have atheistic brain chemistry. And I must have Christian brain chemistry. Well, if that's true, nobody possesses free agency. You can't argue atheism is superior to Christianity on logical reasons when it's not a matter of logic, it's a matter of physical determinism based on your brain chemistry. But if we are free, Calvinists have to be very careful when they use the F word, free. But if we possess free agency, how do we explain that? I think it makes more sense in a Christian context. How about the enigmatic nature of human beings? Pascal, one of my favorite thinkers, he said, human beings are great and wretched. He thought Christianity provided the best explanation for human beings. Again, if I could quote Hugh Ross said that if we have evolved from the primates, he doesn't think we would be as evil as we are. He doesn't perceive the animal kingdom as having any kind of the meanness, the nastiness that's in human beings. And Ross's explanation is because we're made in the image of God, and as fallen creatures, we now use our giftedness for evil purposes. So the reason human beings are able to create Auschwitz, which I don't think bears would ever do, I don't think highly intelligent primates would do, but humans do. And Pascal would say the greatness and the wretched. Now we use the greatness for exclusively wretched purposes, or almost exclusively wretched purposes. How about the moral and aesthetic impulses? How about our need for meaning and purpose in life? I think humans need some kind of explanation. I guarantee if you came down the track and you were put off right in front of Auschwitz, on average, you would live for 2 days. the Jews and the other groups of people, gypsies, Slavs, homosexuals, who landed at Auschwitz in Poland. And notice how the train track comes right up to the front of the camp. If you were there, you were going to live on an average of 2 days. Why is it that humans possess seemingly this greatness and this wretchedness? We can build a shuttle that will take us into interstellar space. Shakespeare has been called, by the way, the man of the century. We can write the plays of Shakespeare, at least some people can. Paint the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo. But then we're involved in racism. We're involved in extermination of different groups that we dislike. How about religious phenomena? Why are people so religious? Well, it seems to me the naturalist just says this. They say, well, evolution is the reason you're religious. Well, how so? Well, religion somehow makes you a better person to survive. So believing that there's life after death, believing that there's an infinite, eternal, all-powerful, all-knowing, loving God, and believing that you're going to survive death, that's going to make you survive. So that's why evolution put all that religion in your mind. Well, I like it when they say things like that. Because if immortality and the existence of God and objective moral values, which they say are not true, none of those beliefs are true, but evolution produced those beliefs in your mind because those beliefs would help you survive better. Well, this I think is completely self-defeating. Because what that tells us then is that evolution can put false beliefs in our mind. Evolution produces thoughts in our mind that are categorically false. If it's true that evolution produces thoughts in our minds that are false, then why should I ever trust my mind to believe that evolution is true? This is Plantica's evolutionary argument against naturalism. Plantica says that if evolution is true, that's a good reason to believe naturalism is false. Because if evolution is unguided, now there are religious people who believe in evolution, but they see it as a God-guided evolution. We sometimes refer to it as theistic evolution. I mentioned Francis Collins is a very good example. Michael Behe is an example of a theistic evolutionist. Well, if God used evolution to create us, most of my philosophical problems with evolution fall away. I mean, if God decided to use that mechanism, remember, God is the one who is designing it. He's the one who's making sure that it all falls into place. But if theistic evolution is true, then the theological problems come to bear. How do you have a personal Adam and Eve when most theistic evolutionists say the early chapters of Genesis are purely allegorical or mythical? How does original sin get passed on if Adam was not a historical person? So theistic evolution, it seems to me, explains my philosophical problems with evolution, but then it creates all kinds of theological problems. But that's not the point. The point I want you to grasp is this. If there's no God to guide evolution, and if evolution is filling your head with false ideas, you have every right to question whether evolution itself is true. I think this is self-defeating. Now, how do we explain religion? Do you recognize this picture? What tradition does this picture of Christ come from? Anybody know? Actually, I think it's an Eastern Orthodox painting. Sometimes you can kind of tell. I think this has more association with the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's always interesting to me that different Christian traditions look at Christian art very differently. Calvinists are usually very mistrustful of religious art. And I think largely because Calvin thought that Christian art is used so much in terms of idolatry. But I think this is a pretty cool picture of Jesus, so we'll use it. Well, how does a person reasonably explain the life, death, and resurrection of Christ? Well, I guess one way is just to say he never existed. But there are very few historians who reason that way. It's usually New Testament liberal scholars who reason that way. It's not historians who reason that way. I guess maybe another way you could try to do it is to say, well, Jesus really did exist, but there's a difference between the historical Jesus and then this other religious, the Jesus, the Christ of faith. There's the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, and they're very different. The Jesus of history was just kind of a moral reformer, and then the church created a Jesus to correspond to their existential religious needs. And I don't think we've ever gotten to the end of that road. But that is just filled with all kinds of problems. Number one, the Gospels that describe Jesus appeared very early in church history. There isn't a lot of time for legend and myth to embellish all of these ideas. What we actually know is that the best textual evidence is the early preachers of the Christian message claimed to be eyewitnesses of these events. So how do we go about explaining Jesus? Well, the early church said the best way to explain the Jesus phenomenon was that he is God in human flesh. He's actually the Messiah the Jews were expecting. And he was raised bodily from the dead. Well, the realities of the world and life match what the Bible teaches about God's creating the universe, particularly his creation of human beings in his own image. We call that the Imago Dei. Some Christian philosophers argue that God's existence can be legitimately inferred as a necessary causal explanation for reality. This is called abduction, an inference to the best explanation. I would say that I have held all of the school of apologetic theories at one time or another in my life. I was first a historic evidentialist. I cut my teeth reading John Warwick Montgomery and Walter Ralston Martin. And so I was an evidentialist. And then I met Greg Bahnsen and began reading Cornelius Van Til, and I became a presuppositionalist. And then I read Alvin Plantinga, and I embraced the new Reformed epistemology, that God's existence is properly basic. And then I read Augustine and thought, all of this is in Augustine. Well, now I have actually reached a point where I would say I hold an abductive view of apologetics. I would simply say, I think Christianity is the best explanation for all of reality. I think Christianity is the best inference to explain the nature of reality. So now I engage in abductive apologetics. All of these kind of schools of thought. And I think in one sense, the abductive approach takes the strengths of these views. So with all due respect to my former teachers who shaped me in these directions, I've come down to the conclusion that the best way to reason is Christianity seems to make sense of the things we see and the things we can't see. So I'm kind of like a scientist. I look at the data and I come up with a model and say, this model explains that data. I'm kind of like a crime scene investigator. I come up with this plausible theory and say, this explains all the data at the crime scene. I'm kind of like a historian who looks at all the facts and says, well, here's the best plausible explanation of what happened. That's the way I reason now apologetically. That doesn't mean that I don't think there are strengths in the evidentialist, the presuppositionalist, and these other schools of thought. I'm just more satisfied with reasoning this way. This is the way policemen reason. It's the way historians reason. It's the way detectives reason. It seems to be a very natural way of explaining things. Which has the best model of explanation? For me, it's Christianity. However, the Christian worldview overall does not naively assume divine activity or intervention as an explanation for whatever humans cannot yet explain. They call this the God of the Gaps theory or presumption, but rather offers a genuine and valid explanatory theory for the nature of life's reality. So I want you to understand this point. I don't think we should reason God of the Gaps. I don't think when we study science and we say, well, we can't explain this, can't understand how life began. And by the way, the smartest people on the planet have been investigating how life began for the last 50 years, and they've come to a dead end. They don't know how it happened. And they're rather embarrassed by it all. So now they, and you can see this in NASA, now they're saying maybe life didn't begin here. It began in outer space. They call this panspermia. That's why there's all of this emphasis on going to Mars. Maybe life began there and it was transported to Earth. Well, the point I'm making here is I think this shows you how much naturalism has not been able to explain things. But I don't think we should say, we can't explain life, God did it. We can't explain this, God did it. No. Not the knee-jerk reaction. I'm suggesting we do this abductive form of reasoning where we say, hey, let's look at all the data. Which theory has the best explanation for all the data? We're reasoning like a policeman, a detective, a lawyer, a doctor. When I was very sick, four of the doctors were standing outside my room and I could hear them talking. And I have to tell you, Tom, you'll enjoy this as a neurologist. I found it very interesting that doctors are less certain about their theories when they're not in your presence. You know, when the patients are not listening, they have all these questions and doubts and confusions, and you know, they're wide open to criticism. But when they're with you, it's like then they take on the divine perspective. Well, I can only tell you, I was really interested, and I found it very interesting that doctors are much more empirical. You know, they don't know. Maybe it's this. Maybe, well, let's try this. If that doesn't work, well, let's try this. But I also have to say, when you're the patient, you don't want your doctors sounding like they don't know what's going on. What do you mean you don't know what's going on? I'm sick. Help me, right? But that's exactly what my doctors did. They would say, well, it could be brain cancer. Well, how will you know if it's brain cancer? Well, certain things will start to take place. You'll start to lose your intellectual faculties, but you're not. So that makes me think maybe it's not brain cancer. Well, what do you think it is? Well, you know, it could be infection, but, well, how do you know that? Well, we have to take a piece of your lung, and then we presume that what's in your lung is in your brain. I'm thinking, you know, this science business, it's kind of up in the air. And then, of course, what's really wonderful about all your doctors is they feel this moral obligation to always tell you exactly how many people have died who had your illness. 40% of the people who have your illness die. You know, and you're told that about 18 times, and it's like, okay, I don't want to hear it again. You know, give me some hope, right? Well, That's right. Now, this, of course, is the way I'm suggesting we reason. Because we like doctors. Why do we like them? Because they help us to stay alive. We like them because they give us a better life. Science, technology, we respect them. We respect them, we pay them well. When a doctor comes to you and gives you his diagnosis, you take it very seriously because they're people who are trusted, and they're trusted because they approach things from a perspective that you have confidence in. Well, what I'm suggesting tonight is if we reason the way Tom reasons as a neurologist, we offer an explanatory theory that best explains the data. I think that's a very powerful way of showing the credibility of Christianity. Because in an important respect, we're doing what these other credible people do. Now, I'm sure not everybody's going to agree. If Greg Bahnsen were here, he would probably be saying, Ken, what has happened to you that you have come to this position. Or if Montgomery was here, he would say, the prodigal son has left, the father, and all these kinds of things. Skeptical philosophies of life, such as naturalism and postmodernism, have real difficulty trying to justify these wondrous truths on this basis. Christian theism's explanatory power appears to be far superior to that of secularism. Christianity seems to explain more, a broader array of things. So let's look at the cumulative test now. We've looked at the question of explanatory power and scope. How about the cumulative test? Is the worldview supported by multiple lines of converging evidence that together add increasing support for its truth claims and extend the breadth of its explanatory power? I don't think it's good if you have one argument to prove your case. I don't think Johnny apologetic one-note is a good thing. I think truth is going to correspond to a variety of things, a cumulative case. I remember when they were trying O.J. Simpson for killing those two people in Los Angeles. And I listened to some of the evidence in court. And it wasn't one piece of evidence that made me conclude that O.J. killed these two people. It was a cumulative case. You know, I remember one of the jurors said, there wasn't enough blood in the Bronco. I thought, why is there any blood in the Bronco? Why are these two people's blood in O.J.'s car? Is there any blood in your car? Is the blood of other people in your car? Probably not. A cumulative case. And so are there a converging amount of evidence to support Christianity? And I think the answer to that clearly is true, yes. An array of data from various fields of inquiry illustrates the historic Christian worldview's explanatory power and makes its case for truthfulness even stronger. Let's look at a variety of fields. Cosmology, the universe had a singular beginning, that's consistent with what the Bible says. There's a beginning to time, that's consistent with what the Bible says. It's not consistent with what Hinduism or Buddhism says. I read a recent book by the Dalai Lama, and he said if science could disprove Buddhism, he'd give it up. And the Dalai Lama said that presently, modern cosmology supports theism. But he said, I'm still holding out that science will ultimately discover that the universe had no beginning. And then I can hold on to my Buddhism. But I was very impressed. The Dalai Lama said, if my worldview, if my Buddhist worldview could be falsified, I'd have to give it up. Wow. That's quite a candid admission. Of course, he's going to decide which evidence will ultimately prove it. But he was going out on the limb and saying, you know what, if you could really come up with conclusive evidence that Buddhism is false, then I guess I'm not the 14th reincarnation of the Buddha after all. Which is a pretty powerful statement. I actually was very impressed with the Dalai Lama. He is a very, very bright bulb. Astrophysics, nature's laws appear fine-tuned. They appear designed to allow for human life. We call this the anthropic principle. So do the universe's content and system, the galaxy, the stars and the planets. They all seem fine-tuned to allow for the emergence of human beings. Now, is there other explanations besides the Bible for those types of things? Yes. But all of those things are consistent with what the Bible says. God created the universe and he created it to bring himself glory. He created human beings. He designed all of these things. How about biology and chemistry? Life systems yield evidence of having been intelligently designed. My colleague Fuzz Rana has an interesting quote from a leading evolutionary biologist who says, you have to keep telling yourself that all of this happened by accident. Because it looks like it was designed. Wow. That's quite an admission. Keep telling yourself it all happened by chance. Because it looks like there was a mind behind it. Well, that's consistent with Christianity. The biochemists now talk about these molecular motors. There are actually motors inside the cell of your body. And the motors in there actually have parts that are very similar to the way engineers create engines and motors. They have rotors, they have all these things. And guess what? The efficiency of the motors in your cell, you can't see them except under, you know, magnification. The efficiency of the motors in our body are much more efficient than any motor any human being or groups of beings have been able to make. Wow. Anthropology and psychology, human beings are richly endowed intellectually but morally flawed. I would say humans are not different in degree from the animals, they're different in kind. Humans are just different than animals. Animals are wonderful. We couldn't exist without the animals, but animals don't play chess. Animals don't do mathematics. Animals don't wonder, what's going to happen to me when I'm dead? Animals don't develop technology. Animals don't take dominion. But animals also don't have our fallenness. You know, I wish bears were not ferocious. I think I'd like to hug a bear. When I see them, I was like, I'd like to hug that bear. But I'm afraid that if I hug him, he will hug me back, and that will be the end of me. How about neuroscience? Humans possess consciousness and a capacity for intellectual and rational reflection. I always tell my students, don't be impressed with the computers. Be impressed with you. Why? Because you have in your brain mind the capacity to put how much information in there? The information that is in 20 million volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's how much space, that's how much RAM you got. That's how much information you can plug into your brain mind. The information that's in 20 million single volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's no computer in the world that could even come with half of that. You have it. And in fact, you naturally and easily do things that computers and cameras cannot do. Like when you watch a movie, the camera can never, you know, it has a picture of me and Michael, the camera's over there. If I'm in focus, he's blurred. If he's in focus, I'm blurred. But you know what? We just turn around and immediately I can focus on your faces. Of course, I tell my students, your problem is not that you have plenty of ability to take things in. It's recalling it. And when you get a little older, those neurons take a little longer, right? What was that guy's name? You know, what happened here? I would suggest to you that neuroscience seems more consistent with the Christian worldview than the naturalist worldview. We talked about math. Mathematical theories correspond to physical reality. Why? Why should it? Unless there's a mind behind the universe. How about logic? Abstract entities, the laws of logic, are universal, invariant, and independent of human conventions. You know what? I can go to Southeast Asia, I can go to Africa, I can go to South America, and I can communicate with people. If I learn their symbols, I can talk with each and every one of them, even though they have a distinct brain chemistry. It's kind of like God networked us together. Ethics, moral absolutes seem intuitively authentic, and moral relativism is self-defeating. Why is moral relativism self-defeating? Well, let's take Martin Luther King and the head of the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan says, I like slavery. I like discrimination. I think black people are not human beings. Dr. King comes along and says, that is false. Human beings should be treated with dignity. Black human beings should be treated with the same dignity that is afforded to any other human being. Well, moral relativism says they're both right. Because whatever you believe is true for you. Well, that's absurd. What I like to tell my students is somebody's wrong. And we know who are wrong. We know that the Klan was wrong. We know Saddam Hussein was wrong. We know we know Eichmann was wrong. And if we accept moral relativism, then nobody's wrong. And I know there are things that are wrong. And I know it's wrong to discriminate against somebody just because their skin is a little different than mine. Religion is a universal phenomenon, and religious experience seems intuitively real and consistent with biblical revelation. Why are people so religious? If God created us in His image and we have an innate sense of God, Calvin in the Institutes talked about the sensus divinitatis. That's very illuminating. History, credible historical reports corroborate the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I recommend you read my book, Without a Doubt, where I talk about 10 different extra-biblical sources that talk about Jesus within just a couple generations of His death. Philosophy, why human beings crave meaning, purpose, and immortality. I cannot not think about these things. Every day of my life, I think about God, I think about death, and I think about immortality. And I cannot not think about those things. And I think that many of us think about those things. And even those of us who tend to kind of suppress those thoughts during times of crisis and trial think about those things. I would describe it this way. I cannot not read. When I eat breakfast, I have to be reading the box. Give me something to read. I cannot not read. The worst thing in the world is for me not to have a book to read, right? So I got to read. Well, I would also say it's similar to this. I cannot not think about God, death, and immortality. Why? How do we explain that? Well, from a Christian worldview, because God's put those things inside you. Okay. This is a pretty blurry picture. I'm sorry for that. Some of you, of course, recognize this as the great painting by the artist Raphael, who was a friend of Michelangelo. Raphael painted this. It's called The School of Athens, and the two figures right in the middle, the one in the red, that, of course, is Plato, and the one in the blue is Aristotle. And the two men are walking through the school. The fellow right here in the front who has his arm up like that, that's Michelangelo. Raphael and Michelangelo worked together side by side, well, just a few feet apart from each other for decades. And there are all kinds of other historical individuals in this painting. Well, Plato, in the red, he, of course, has his finger up. He's talking about the forms. Reality is in the objective forms. Aristotle has his hand down. He's saying, no, reality is here in this world. Why do human beings ask the why questions? And why don't more people ask the why questions? Why do we do that? These multiple lines of converging evidence support and verify the Christian worldview's basic truth claims. Christian theism supplies a lens through which to view the world that is uniquely reasonable, testable, viable, workable, livable, and highly competitive in the marketplace of ideas. Next week, actually in 2 weeks, because next week you're going to be eating leftovers of turkey. Next week we won't have an academy because of Thanksgiving. But the next time we meet, I'm going to talk about another test, and that's theism's correspondence and verification. So we'll be looking at the various tests that we take here. And there, of course, is the copy of my book, A World of Difference. Let's see if we have some questions or comments. Feel free to go to the mic and ask what you'd like.
I have two questions for you.
Okay. Yeah, great. Great questions. First one was on Islam. And the second one is, of course, a reading culture. Terrific questions. Thank you for such thoughtful questions. The first, Islam. Algebra is an Arabic word. In the 8th, 9th, and 10th century, Islam was undergoing a renaissance. the Europeans were living in caves. The Muslims were reading Aristotle. They were translating the Roman, the Latin and Greek manuscripts into Arabic. The Muslims were making great contributions in philosophy, in mathematics, and in medicine. Some of the Muslims were the first people to say, it might be a good idea to wash your hands before you treat a wound, for example. And Islam had a very advanced culture. I would also tell you, by the time Thomas Aquinas comes along, Thomas's dates are 1224 to 1274. 1225 to 1274. So by the 13th century, Thomas says that the Muslim civilization is so sophisticated, he writes one of his greatest books, Summa Contra Gentilis, a summary to the Gentile mind, the non-Christian mind, and he thinks that Islam is about to eclipse the West. Now, if Thomas thought that, I'm not a Roman Catholic anymore. I used to be. And I have some criticisms for Thomas, but I have to say that Thomas Aquinas is such a brilliant intellectual that I think he is one of the greatest thinkers in the history of Christianity. He thought Islam was the culture and the civilization was a significant threat to the Christian West. Now, of course, the question is, what has happened? What has happened? Some people that I read who know these issues much better than I do, who spent their entire life studying Islam, who read Arabic, who stay up on all this material, they say things like, that was a time when there was more tolerance in Islam. It seemed to be more of a cosmopolitan Islamic culture. So there was a little bit more respect for people of the book, which would include Jews and Christians. There was also maybe less of a fundamentalist Islam represented at the time. But I think it is very clear now that large portions of the Islamic world are intellectually impoverished. And there's very little tolerance of anything other than kind of the jihad, the radical type of Islam. Now, I do think, though, there are things that we want to say about Islam. In my book, I talk about positive worldview elements of Islam. Number one, they have had in their history a respect for reason, rationality, logic, science. So they're not like Hinduism and the Eastern religions that say, you know, you should revel in contradiction. They're not that way. In fact, there are quite a number of Islamic scholars today who are engineers, who are biologists. They love science. They believe the Quran is a scientifically accurate document. So those are positives toward Islam. Another positive I think about Islam is it is an intellectual culture during that time. It seems, however, and here I'm quoting Stanley Yaki. Yaki is a Roman Catholic scholar, recently passed away. I think Yaki may have been one of the most learned philosophers and historians of science. He wrote a book years ago. It's not an easy read, but it is a very provocative read. He called it Christ, the Savior of Science. And Yaki argued that the reason Islam began to decline intellectually, culturally, scientifically, was because Allah is arbitrary. In Islam, Allah can contradict himself. He can abrogate what went before. Yaki essentially argues that Islam did not have the kind of religion that could retain the intellectual elements. I suspect too many people would say that fundamentalism caught up with Islam. Now, your other question I find really, really interesting. One of the pleasures of my life is I got to talk with Mortimer Adler before he passed away. I felt like a kid in the candy store, you know, talking to Dr. Adler. I think Adler might be the most educated person of the 20th century. And we talked a little bit about learning and culture, and I told them that he had influenced the way I educated my kids, and his last word to me was, "You made my day." I like Rabbi Zacharias a lot. I think he is a very, very capable Christian apologist, and I think he's touched on something that I think is very, very powerful. You know, we are part of the people of the book. And I mentioned earlier in my talk this evening that, you know, Judaism is this tiny little religion. I think now in Israel there are 6 million Jews. You know, probably worldwide there's probably far less than 20 million Jews worldwide as compared to 2.5 billion within Christendom, maybe close to 1.5 billion in Islam. Judaism is this minority religion, this little tiny religion. Of course, they've beat the Arabs in 6 wars, which I've always puzzled me that you have these huge Islamic countries, they attack this little sliver of a country, and these Jews just lay them out. Of course, it helps when you've got American technology. And it also helps when you've had to face the Nazis, and so you figure, well, when the Nazis come again, we're going to fight them. And so they won't back down. But my point is not the military. My point is the people of a book. Though Judaism is maybe the smallest religion, or one of them, I guess Zoroastrianism is smaller, maybe only 100,000 within the whole world. Judaism is a minority religion. I'm not sure, however, there have been greater intellectual accomplishments made by any other religion over the Jews. And you know what? I think in one way it probably can be reduced to a pretty simple principle. If you can't read, you can't read the Word of God. And I think what drove Judaism in its most fundamental element was that they were a people of the book. And Yahweh told Moses, write down these words. And that culture has been thriving. America has said that the Jews are the most successful minority in the history of America. I think, of course, they were measuring it in terms of money and, you know, lawyers, doctors, that type of element. But I think it's probably more foundational. It seems to me that Judaism has never lost its mind. I think Christianity from time to time has lost its mind. And what I mean by that is, I think we've lost the love of the mind to the glory of God. And I can't tell you how important it is. I have two of my children here tonight. I have told both of them that I think the most important thing in their life, educationally, is to love reading and to love learning. And I'm less concerned about the marks they get on their report card than I am about their passion for ideas. If they can sit down with me after dinner and they can track with me, when I drive home tonight, we'll have a little dialogue in the car and I'll say, well, what did you think of this and what did you think of that? If they can stay up with me, that's more important to me than the grades they get. Although, I kind of like to see some good grades once in a while as well. It helps when Christmas presents come along. Right, buddy? This idea, I think, is really, really, really important. And I think today we have Christians who've lost their mind. And I don't think it bodes well for the faith. You know, I'm a pretty proud Calvinist. I haven't always been a Calvinist. I converted later in life. I can tell you, however, that in the Reformed tradition, we've got some pretty heavy guns. There is plenty of scholarship in our tradition. You can be an intellectual and be a Calvinist. And that's good, because I couldn't be a Calvinist if you couldn't be. I think the same is Lutherans. The Lutheran Church is a sliver of a church. It's a small church, particularly the conservative Lutherans. How many biblical scholars have they produced? Why? Because Lutheranism, Reformed tradition, and a few other traditions, maybe the Anglican tradition, they're breeding grounds. The reason they produce these scholars is it's a breeding ground. You go into them and they have this sense of loving God. Here's a calling for you, serving the Lord with all of these faculties He's given you. Whereas many of these non-denominational denominations, they're never going to produce a world-famous scholar because they have no breeding ground. They're contemptuous. You didn't go to seminary, you went to cemetery. I think that's very dangerous. And therefore, I don't like reading on the internet. I like books. I like to go to Barnes & Noble and read books. I like to smell the... A new book has a smell to it. I think all of that is just so very critically important. Now, don't get me wrong. God doesn't love intellectuals more than non-intellectuals. But I must also tell you that there is nothing unspiritual about being an intellectual. And I think Islam has clearly lost its way. And I'm afraid that we're losing our way. Thank you for those excellent, excellent questions. Let me see if I can find that slide for you. PowerPoint, you have to have pretty pictures. I've conceded that. Okay, yeah, that's part of it. Go ahead. Yeah, I compliment your insight. I think you've come up with a very important point, and I agree with you. I'm really not trying to diss God of the Gaps thinking here. I am trying to diss a kind of God of the Gaps, but not another kind of God of the Gaps. When Richard Dawkins first heard Michael Behe's concept of irreducible complexity, which I think is a very profound argument for intelligent design, my colleague Fuzz Rana tells me, however, it's just scratching the surface. There are even more profound arguments from molecular motors and things like that, the chicken and the egg kind of thing, that the evolutionist process cannot explain. Richard Dawkins' response to Michael Behe was, give us enough time and we'll figure out how it happened naturally. The naturalist scientist has this incredibly optimistic view of the future. There's an informal logical fallacy called the ad futuris. You know, believe it because we'll prove it to be true in the future. Well, the problem is you don't live in the future, you have to reason in the present. Give me arguments now. Don't give me this rosy picture of the future. Yet I would tell you, though, that many of the scientists feel very good about what they've been able to accomplish. You know, again, if you were born in 1900 here in America and you're a white man, you could expect to live 47 years. If you're a woman and you're an Adventist, you might double that now. In 100 years, life expectancy has doubled. Why? Largely because of science and technology. And they often feel this sense that if you give us enough time, we'll figure out a natural explanation and we won't have to go to the God of the Gaps. And they'll say things like, you know, it used to be that, you know, they thought lightning was, God was moving the furniture around in heaven. But now we know this. What I'm trying to criticize here is, I think, probably an unsophisticated God of the Gaps reasoning. But I'm glad you picked up on this point because I agree with you. There is a guy who is a science writer. His name's John Horgan. I think that's it. Horgan, I think his name is Horgan. He wrote a book entitled The End of Science. And in this book, it's been very controversial, but in this book, he essentially has argued, he talked to some of the greatest scientific minds on the planet. And he wrote this book and said, you know, when it comes to the big issues, science has kind of played its cards. that when it comes to the origin of life, when it comes to the origin of the universe, when it comes to aspects of the origin of humanity, it seems like there are not going to be any more big revolutionary ideas to come out of science. Well, not all scientists agree with that. You know, scientists don't want to feel like they're not going to be on the cutting edge of something. But if that's true, and there are many people, including some of my colleagues at RTB, who believe that, if that's true, science has not been able to explain the big issues of human existence. And therefore, why can't we then say, maybe there is a God that stands behind our gap in human understanding? So I completely agree with you. I think there is a type of God of the gap of reasoning that I think is embarrassing. Because in theology, of course, we believe in causes. God has secondary causes, and sometimes his providential elements are accomplished through secondary causes and things of that nature. Miracles are a very complicated sort of thing. Some miracles are direct. Other miracles are kind of secondary in orientation. So I think we have to be careful the way we reason God of the gaps. But I agree with your point and still feel, however, the better way of explaining it is the inference to the best explanation. Because there we're coming up with a broad theory of explanation and saying it's not just what we don't know. I'm not reasoning to God from what I don't know. I'm reasoning to God from what I do know. And what I know is math and science and logic and ethics and history. So that's what I'm advocating. I'm advocating that we affirm the existence of God based on both what we know and what we don't know, not from just what we don't know. But I appreciate your very subtle point, and I'm not trying to diss God of the Gaps reasoning totally. But I will tell you, I am no longer an evidentialist, presuppositionalist, and I, with all due respect to the great Alvin Plantinga, I don't even know that I'm a proper basicality guy anymore. I think this is a profound way of doing apologetics. I draw the best inference that explains reality. And I like this apologetic way of reasoning. And it takes part of the presuppositional, it takes part of the evidentialist, it takes part of the classical view. It's kind of what I think is a very robust way of reasoning apologetically. And it's the way Tom reasons as a neurologist. It's the way my detective friends reason. They look at the data. They draw an explanation to try to explain the data. It's the way scientists, they come up with a model to explain the data. I think we can say, look, we're not strange. We're not bizarre. We reason the way credible people reason in their areas of discipline. But your point is well taken, and I agree. There's a place for a type of God of the gaps reasoning. And a lot of humility. I want to tell you, I was reading Kim Rutabaugher's article in the New Modern Reformation. He's not here, so I can admit this to you when he's not here. He has an article, if I can find it. It's called Using God by Kim Rutabaugher, and Kim made me totally guilty. He starts off his article by saying that pride is thinking more highly of yourself than you should. And I thought, I didn't think Rutabaugher was this guilt-preaching type individual, but I feel very guilty by all of this. And then he took a shot at America. He said that, you know, you shouldn't think that that God is just in the history of America. And I thought, boy, that's another shot, I feel. Because I tend to look at America, I have to admit, as a shining city on a hill. And so Rutabaugher, without ever being here, made me guilty in about 10 minutes, Alan. What do you think of that? So for a non-legalist preacher, Rutabaugher made me feel pretty guilty. Microphone's free. Anybody want to take a... Let me tackle your first point. I was watching 60 Minutes on Sunday, and they talked about the millennialists. These are young people that were born from 1980 to 1995, which includes all three of my kids. And they said that this new generation, they're very tech savvy. My son is 12 years old. I think he knows magnitudes more about technology, computers, and than I do. All of my kids, I have to go to them to help me function in life when it comes to computer stuff. What's interesting, however, is my son likes video games. But what he has to prove to me is that the video games that he plays involve a significant sense of learning. It's not that I don't think entertainment and amusement. I like vacations. I like, you know, sometimes I want to go home and I just want to veg out. I don't want to do anything. I think there's a place for all of that. I think God wants us to enjoy our lives. That's right. And you know, you look, some of the amazing thing is other nations. You look at India. India has this thriving society. I mean, I ask, when I was in Houston, I asked all of the Exxon guys down there who are, they're part of the Reasons to Believe chapter down there. I said, why are gas prices so high? You know, are you guys gouging us? You guys are making all these profits. Why am I paying, you know, $3.29 a gallon? And one of the comments from them was that both China and India have growing economies, and they're demanding more oil. And there is a scarcity. And India is undergoing this development of technology. But the point I want to make about that is, when I asked those Indian engineers and scientists, how do you jive your development of technology and science with Hinduism? And their response is, we don't believe in Hinduism anymore. Which I think is a worldview issue, isn't it? That's right. But Judaism and Christianity, and to a level Islam, they function very well with science and math and technology. But the Eastern mystical religions, I think, well, there are forms of Hinduism that say the universe is an illusion. And I would actually say that some of the best scholarship is coming out about Newton right now. And Newton may be the greatest scientific thinker the world has ever seen. You know, he had some weird ideas. He also had a prediction of the second coming of Jesus, which I probably won't live long enough to see, but he predicted that Jesus would come, I think, the middle of this century. Is it 2050? So I'd be in my 90s. I don't think I'll make it that far. But anybody else? Last go round at the mic. Yeah, great. Thank you for that question. Well, as I mentioned, John Warwick Montgomery was one of my first teachers, and I figured it's, you know, historical evidentialism is it. And Walter Martin taught me that same method. Then I met Greg Bahnsen. I thought, wow, this is really a different way of reasoning about the truth of the Christian faith. Then I read Plantica, and I thought, maybe I've misunderstood it all. However, I am very smitten by Augustine, and I suspect that Augustine is kind of the father of a lot of these different schools. And I think you're right. I think the reason why I approach it from an abductive approach now and am more comfortable with a cumulative case type of method and reasoning worldview is I think, one, it is more positive. But secondly, I meet a lot of non-Christian intellectuals, and they say to me, you know, what I find troubling about Christianity is you guys have your own unique little weird way of reasoning. It's like you have to be a Christian to reason this way. And I'm suggesting, no, you don't. This is the way doctors reason. It's the way... My father, I remember when I was a boy, my father was an auto mechanic, and my dad would find out all of the people in the neighborhood who were widows and didn't have a husband to tune up the car. So my dad would have them come over and he'd tune up their car for free. And when I was a young man, the lady would pull up and start the engine and rev it up a little bit. And my dad say, "Oh, it's this, this, and this." He didn't even open the hood. He'd say, "It's this, this, and this." And I was like, my dad is a shaman. He is a medicine man. I mean, how could anybody know what's wrong with a car by listening to sound? So, you know, I was like, wow. Well, the older I got, the more I realized that when you study the internal combustion engine, it is a lot like an inductive process. And if certain things go wrong, they evidence themselves by... So my dad was not a shaman. And that wasn't quite as great as when I thought he was a shaman, but... I think mechanics, doctors, scientists, historians reason this way. They look at the data and they ask the question, what is the best explanation for all of this data? Again, there are some people who I guess would criticize this view by saying it doesn't provide certainty. Abductive reasoning is similar to inductive reasoning in that it arises to the level of probability, but it is unlike induction in that it doesn't attempt to predict anything. So, you know, you may think that that is a certain weakness, but in one sense, I still like all the things that Greg Bahnsen talked to me about. And I like reading Cornelius Van Til, and I just see that maybe there is a way of taking the strengths of these. And I want to be able to tell the non-Christian that you don't have to reason in a weird way to be a Christian. You can make sense of all of these kinds of things. And I'm comfortable with it. Maybe in 10 years somebody will come along and I'll say, well, now I have something new. But that might be true, but I actually think that this is a very powerful way of doing apologetics. And I think when it comes to worldviews, I'd rather not argue with a Muslim point, doctrinal point by doctrinal point. I would rather say, here's your worldview. Here's my worldview. I think it exposes you in a way that I'm not exposed. I would agree, however, with your comment you made to me at church. When you're talking to particular groups like the Witnesses or the Mormons, often you have to go back to doctrinal type of issues. But with the big worldview philosophies, I think naturalism is exposed when you look at it from a worldview point of view. I won't argue with them point about evolution to point about creation. I'll go and simply say, how do you account for rationality? So in that sense, I think it is very good. But again, I'm not saying the way I'm reasoning is really different than these other schools as much as it is, I think, an attempt to kind of bring them together in their strengths. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we'll close the academy, and I want to remind you that next week you'll be eating leftovers of turkey. But you can think about that turkey that gave its life so that you could survive. A ransom turkey theory, we might call it. The week after, we will be back, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the other tests. We'll look at correspondence and verification. Wednesday night, I debated John Mark Reynolds about the age of the Earth. Dr. Reynolds took the young Earth view. I took the old Earth view. One of my criticisms of young Earth creationism is I think it's a non-falsifiable theory. If young Earth creationists believe that God built age into the universe, it just looks old, well, how would you ever falsify it? Every evidence would just be an appearance of age. Well, I draw the position, and you might not agree with this, but maybe it's something you can think about for 2 weeks before you come back. I think if there's no way to conceivably falsify something, then I think there's no way to prove it. Now, again, I'm not necessarily arguing a philosophy of science of falsification. I'm just saying, to me, it makes more sense. If there's no way to show how your view can break down, if I just have to accept it, it's hard for me to then think how you're going to go about proving it. With Christianity, and here's where you can question my understanding of the text. I think Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, when he says, you know, if Christ has not been raised, you're of all men most miserable. I think Paul was laying that out, that Christianity is potentially falsifiable. And I think worldviews that carry more of a verification and are open to falsifiability, those worldviews are more robust. And I think our worldview is very robust